This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we clear up some misconceptions about the impeachment process.
We speak with our guest, Alan Hirsch, who's just written Impeaching the President, Past, Present, and Future. How does impeachment work? What do we have in store for us? Give a listen.
We'll also recognize the recent passing of our friend and colleague, Mujahid Farid. We listen to one of our interviews about the importance of releasing aging persons from prison. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Two United States presidents have been impeached, Andrew Johnson in 1868 and Bill Clinton in 1998. Richard Nixon would likely have been impeached, but he resigned in August 1974. Rumblings of impeaching the winner of the 2016 elections even took place before the votes were tallied. Opponents of Hillary Clinton cited her use of a private email server as Secretary of State as reason. Opponents of Donald Trump cited his business interests as disqualifying him. Possible criminal activities involving the Trump campaign added fuel to those calls. Restraints on executive power exist because the greatest risk of tyranny comes from the executive branch. That's partly because a president is a single person. In contrast, Congress and the Supreme Court must persuade a majority of their colleagues in order to take action. In addition, presidential authority as commander-in-chief involves the power to deploy weaponry as the head of the military and law enforcement. The nation's founding fathers valued checks on tyranny, in part because of oppression by the British monarchy. At the Constitutional Convention, some delegates opposed making one person responsible for executing the nation's laws. While it decided in favor of the one-person executive, it adopted provisions aimed at preventing the president from becoming king-like. Limits included four-year terms and voter approval to remain in office. The founders knew that even in 4 years, a president could do much damage, so they created a mechanism for faster replacement of the president if needed. The House of Representatives could impeach him, an accusation of wrongdoing that would prompt a trial in the Senate. If the Senate voted by two-thirds vote to convict the president, it would automatically result in removal from office. Impeachment can also be used to remove all federal officers. Joining us today to talk about his new book, Impeaching the President, Past, Present, and Future, is Alan Hirsch. Alan is a lecturer in humanities and chair of justice and law studies at Williams College. He is also the author of For the People, What the Constitution Really Says About Your Rights, and A Citizen's Guide to Impeachment. Welcome, Alan, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Let's start by telling our audience what the difference is between impeachment and the 25th Amendment.
Right. So impeachment is the means by which an unfit president is removed by Congress, has to be impeached or accused by the House of Representatives, and then convicted by two-thirds of the Senate of having committed a high crime and misdemeanor or treason or bribery. So that's a means of getting rid of a president who has done something wrong. The 25th Amendment is an alternative means of getting rid of a president who is unfit, not because he has demonstrated his unfitness with specific constitutionally criminal actions, so to speak, but because of some physical or perhaps mental incapacity that renders him or her unable to discharge the duties of the office. And the procedure is completely different. This is initiated not openly by Congress, but by the vice president and half of the cabinet. They send notice to the Congress that the president is unfit. He has a chance to show that he is fit by responding, and then it will be up to the Congress to decide it. But it's only temporary. And if the president reclaims his fitness, so to speak, at any point, he can then reclaim the powers of the office.
Now, just to clarify something, being impeached does not necessarily mean that a president is removed.
That's one of the great misconceptions about impeachment. People think a president is impeached, he's out. But that's not the case. Impeachment, think of it by analogy to the criminal justice system. Impeachment is an indictment. So it's an accusation, and it would be waged by the House of Representatives. Then the impeached president has a trial, the opportunity to show that he's innocent of the charges. That goes before the Senate, which needs two-thirds vote. The House only needs a majority to impeach, but the Senate needs two-thirds to convict and thereby remove the president. So we've had two impeachments in our history, but neither time was the president found guilty. So we've had no presidents removed from office via the impeachment process. Richard Nixon resigned under imminent threat of impeachment, but that's it.
Do you believe the founders were wise to vest the power to impeach with Congress versus the Supreme Court?
So this is a really interesting question. Is impeachment a political process? And if so, if that is a bad thing. So as you say, the founders gave Congress the power to impeach. I think they did so wisely. But in the process, they gave this constitutional process a necessary political element, because members of Congress will always read their mail, check the polls. But I think that's a good thing, because what this ensures is impeachment will happen not only or not simply because the president has done something wrong, but also when the public has been brought along, when the public acknowledges that the president must be removed. And it's so dangerous to remove a popularly elected leader, someone who's gotten 60 million votes, by a handful of elected or unelected, in the case of judges, government officials. You want the country to be back any process when a president is removed. So having it be a partially political process, I think, is healthy.
Alan, the Constitution authorizes impeachment for, quote, treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. What are high crimes and misdemeanors?
The million-dollar question when it comes to impeachment, and it's difficult to answer, but I'll do my best. It's easiest to say what high crimes and misdemeanors are not. Notwithstanding the word misdemeanor, they're not minor matters, even if technically criminal. So you're not going to get a president removed for a traffic violation or for fishing without a license or for littering, even though those are actually crimes. Typically, high crimes and misdemeanors will not involve private misconduct, although there are exceptions. No one disputes that a president who commits murder or armed robbery or something like that would have to be removed. But such exceptions aside, by and large, high crimes and misdemeanors involve an abuse of the presidential office and an abuse of the public trust in a way that compromises the legitimacy of our government. Now, just as not all technical crimes will fall into that category, you don't need a technical crime, something that's literally a statute on the books, in order for something to be what we'll call a constitutional crime. So, for example, if the president were to pardon all members of his own party, I think everyone would agree that would be an impeachable offense, just a blatant misuse of the pardon power. And any power that the president blatantly misuses in that way would be an impeachable offense, a high crime and misdemeanor, even though there's no statute which would allow the president to be punished criminally for that. So I realize that's a bit of a long-winded answer, but it's a complicated question, and it really has to be worked out on a case-by-case basis. We don't have some master list of high crimes and misdemeanors.
Alan, your book talks about the past, the present, and the future. Could you give us a brief summary of the impeachment of Andrew Johnson? Why was he impeached?
Right. So ultimately, it was because of a political tug of war between Johnson, a Democrat, and the Republicans who controlled Congress. Now, the brief backstory is Johnson was Abraham Lincoln's vice president. Lincoln was a Republican. He chose Johnson to try to unify the nation during the Civil War. But when Lincoln's assassinated, all of a sudden you have a Democratic president, a Republican Congress, and the principal issue of the day was Reconstruction. How fast and aggressively was Congress going to move to make the South, remake it in the image of the North, that is, make it provide racial justice for African Americans? That was the Reconstruction effort. The radical Republicans who controlled Congress wanted that to happen fast and aggressively. And Johnson, who was a Southerner, he was a slaveholder, he felt Reconstruction should be a slower, more gradual process. And that's what led to his impeachment. But the specific act that was impeachable, according to those who impeached him, was his violation of a law Congress passed in 1867 called the Tenure of Office Act, which really was impeachment bait. They passed this law, which made it impossible for Johnson to remove certain cabinet officials without Senate approval. They expected he would violate that, and he did. He eventually discharged his Secretary of War, with whom he had major disagreements, and Congress pounced, and they impeached him primarily for that. And I think history will or has judged that Johnson was in the wrong when it came to Reconstruction. But the Republicans in Congress who impeached him were in the wrong in treating his political or moral failures as constitutional failures. His violation of the Tenure of Office Act was not an impeachable offense. This should have been litigated by the courts. He, in good faith, felt that the act was unconstitutional, a view that was eventually vindicated decades later by the Supreme Court. He also had doubts that it applied to the particular person he discharged. So these were technical matters. This is not the stuff for which someone should be impeached. But they felt that they could impeach him, and therefore they did. In other words, it was essentially a power play. The much wiser course of action would have been to allow the voters to effectively impeach Johnson in the 1868 election, which wasn't that far away. But the Republicans were impatient. Their impatience is understandable. They were fighting a great moral and political cause, but they misused the constitutional tool of impeachment in the service of that cause.
I thought it was interesting you talked about the seven Republicans who voted to acquit Johnson. They were the so-called seven tall men. None was reelected to the Senate, and one, Edmund Ross, appeared to support conviction but later changed his mind. Ross received posthumous glory, meriting a chapter in John F. Kennedy's book Profiles in Courage, and Kennedy called his vote the most heroic act in U.S.
Yes. So history has judged the so-called seven tall men, as you point out, the seven Republicans who did not go along with their party. If they had, they only needed two of them, actually. Impeachment, conviction in the Senate fell short by one vote on account of these seven Republicans crossing party lines and voting to acquit Johnson. And Kennedy, for whatever reasons, chose to glamorize one particular man. And there's subsequently been evidence that Ross and maybe others received bribes. So history, as always, is very muddy in this regard. But I do think one of the real lessons of the Johnson episode, the Nixon and Clinton episodes, all three historical impeachment sagas, is how crucial bipartisanship is, how crucial it is that members of the opposing party, the minority party in this process, be open-minded, and that members of the majority party not automatically impeach a president simply because they can. And one of the things I insist on in the book is that any time impeachment is contemplated, all members of Congress, and for that matter all of us as citizens, should do our best to apply what I call the shoe test, which is imagine if the shoe were on the other foot. If this were a president of the other party, and you're calling for impeachment, would you be calling for it if it were a president of your party? And if you're resisting impeachment, would you be doing that if the opposition president had done the things that the president of your party did? And this is done all too little. We find in all these episodes of history, most people act according to party loyalty. But in every single episode, there have been a handful of heroes. And in the Johnson case, it was these seven Republicans who resisted the tide and voted to acquit Johnson correctly.
We're speaking with Professor Alan Hirsch, who's recently authored Impeaching the President, Past, Present, and Future. Alan, I just want to say as an aside, my shoe test would be to take my shoe off and throw it. In any case, let's turn our attention to one of our favorite presidents, Richard Nixon. The Judiciary Committee passed an article of impeachment alleging obstruction of justice. One accused Nixon of abuse of power, and a third was based on the administration's defiance of the committee's subpoena to turn over the tapes and other documents. The committee sent a report to the full House of Representatives recommending impeachment on these three grounds. What happened next?
Well, fortunately, nothing had to happen because the Supreme Court intervened, ordering Nixon to turn over the tapes. His secret recordings of conversations in the White House, which established undeniably his guilt, at least with respect to two of those three charges. And as a result, the Republicans caved, which is, I shouldn't use that. That's a pejorative word, but they acted properly. They acted nobly. And they indicated that in the House they were going to impeach Nixon. In the Senate they were going to convict him. And faced with that imminent disaster, he resigned the office. So this is the historical success story of impeachment. I think history and historians look less than fondly on those who tried to get rid of Andrew Johnson. Ditto Bill Clinton, although it's a little less clear. But in the case of Nixon, I think everyone agrees that the proper result was reached, that he had to leave office. And fortunately, he realized as much only because Congress realized as much. They were going to get rid of him anyway. And he stepped down and spared the nation the trauma of a protracted impeachment process and impeachment trial.
Alan, polls showed that roughly 60% of the American people opposed impeachment in the case of Bill Clinton. And Democrats continued to lobby Republicans to accept a compromise of censuring Clinton. That measure was also approved by a majority of Americans. You, in your lessons, list that support from the people is critical, in addition to what you just talked about, bipartisan being important, and for the good of the nation. What's your assessment of the Clinton impeachment?
Yeah, so I think it was a mistake on a number of grounds, and you put your finger on one of them, which is simply the country didn't agree. You know, you had a legitimate judgment call on whether perjury in an entirely private context, and in, to be fair to the president, a lawsuit that was somewhat politically motivated or at least supported by enemies of the president. In that very private context, he was asked questions that were later deemed immaterial to the lawsuit, and he committed perjury. He did not tell the truth, and he's subsequently been punished, I think appropriately. His bar license was removed, and he was fined. But in terms of this being an impeachable offense, it was simply too peripheral to the office of the presidency. It was, I don't ever want to call perjury minor, but it really just didn't go to his conduct in office as president. It was about a private matter, and it was about a lies about a sexual relationship, which, so in that context, I think it was a mistake to impeach him, but not simply or even mostly because that's my judgment, but that was the judgment of the American people. And at the time Clinton was impeached, it was known. The senators told the House, you know, you're never going to get the two-thirds to convict him. And I argue in the book that impeachment is not a symbolic matter. It should not be used to score political points or to make a point. It should be used when there is a legitimate chance to remove the president from office. Now, maybe you don't have all the votes when you start. Maybe the process will be somewhat persuasive and educational. But in this case, the facts were all known. Everyone's judgments were in. No one's opinion was changed. And we just dragged the country through a very divisive and dangerous process. So I judge the Clinton, as do most historians, the Clinton impeachment as a mistake as well, like the Johnson impeachment.
Are we the only country that has something like impeachment?
I think we're the only country that has it in the form that we do. Parliamentary countries have means of getting rid of the president which are actually much more easy and frequent. A vote of no confidence, or you call for a special election at any time. And that's just not our system. And I think people who too easily reach for impeachment the moment they dislike a president are failing to recognize that crucial distinction between our form of democracy and these parliamentary forms.
Alan Hirsch, how do you respond to people, and there are a lot of them, who are calling for Trump's impeachment? What do you say?
Well, the first thing I would say, in terms of it being a last resort, not a first resort, and trying to tell people to calm down and be careful about this, is that the idea of a representative democracy is that the people choose their leaders. And people invest much more commitment and passion to electing the president than any other office for obvious reasons. It's the most powerful person in the land. And removing a popularly elected president through congressional action is potentially a slap in the face of 60 million Americans. And they'll want to get revenge, and they'll want to impeach your president the next time. When we actively disapprove of a president, as many do of Trump, it's easy to get swept up in a movement to get rid of that president. But things will look very different when it's a president we support on the receiving end. And the last thing you want in a democracy is millions of people believing either that their vote doesn't count or that there's a shortcut to getting their way. Now, having said all that, I believe some of the charges against Trump are very serious. And I think if proven, merit impeachment. So I don't mean to come across as someone who says we should not impeach at any cost. I think we simply have to be very careful. It's too early to say right now whether Trump has committed impeachable offenses, and I'm happy to go into that if you'd like.
Yeah, I'd like to. That was my next question. What do you think he's done or may have done that's serious enough to warrant impeachment?
Right. It's a great question, and I just want to emphasize at the outset, we need to wait for the Mueller report to know what he has in fact done, and also what federal prosecutors in New York find with respect to the Stormy Daniels payouts, because that's something that looks like Mueller has deferred to them. But yes, in the book, I do discuss which charges, if proven, would merit impeachment. And since so many things have been thrown out there, if you don't mind, I'm going to start with those charges that I think would probably not support impeachment.
Yeah, do
yes.
it.
Okay. So one of those would be his alleged misuse of the pardon power. So he pardoned Sheriff Joe Arpaio largely, it seems, because he was a political ally. He pardoned Scooter Libby, arguably, to send a message about his willingness to use the pardon power. But I don't think either of those pardons were beyond the constitutional pale. Now, the Constitution gives the president pretty much absolute power to pardon. That doesn't mean he could never misuse the power such that he could be impeached. If he were to pardon himself or family members, that could be a different story. But I think the kind of pardons he's engaged in so far are close enough to the historically accepted pardons that they would not be a basis for impeachment. Now, even before he took office, there were people who thought that he was in violation of the emoluments clauses of the Constitution, which basically require that the president not receive profits from any business interest, that his salary is paid by the American people, and that should be his only interest. So there were those who said that unless he divests his business interests or at a minimum puts them in a blind trust, that would be impeachable. The problem here is there's little precedent about the scope of these clauses historically. And Trump is entitled to a court ruling on possible violations. This is kind of analogous to Andrew Johnson and the Tenure of Office Act. Maybe he acted in violation of the Constitution with respect to this statute, but he didn't think so. And in our system of government, when the two branches, the political branches, disagree, the courts resolve it. Now, if there were, and there are now cases pending in which Trump has been sued for being in violation of the emoluments clauses, and some of those cases are proceeding. If there is a court ruling that he is in violation and he disrespects, ignores the court ruling, does not take appropriate action with respect to his business holdings, that might be ground for impeachment. But the mere fact that a lot of people may currently think that he's in violation of the Constitution, that would not be a basis for impeachment. Now we come to the things that I believe would be impeachable were they proven. If the Trump campaign, with his knowledge and approval, coordinated with the Russians covertly during a presidential election to assist his campaign, it seems to me clear that would be an impeachable offense. And that, of course, is at the heart of the Mueller investigation. If he engaged in efforts designed to cover up and obstruct an investigation into such activities, that would be grounds for impeachment. And that's true, this is an important distinction, even if there was no underlying crime. If it turns out that the Trump campaign did nothing particularly improper or illegal with respect to Russia, but nevertheless, to spare embarrassment or because they weren't taking any chances or for whatever reason, the president interfered with the investigation, tried to prevent it from going forward, that would absolutely be an independent, legitimate basis for impeachment. Finally, and this is something I know some people disagree about, but I believe the payments to Stormy Daniels and Susan McDougal, if Trump knew about them and if they were ill-motivated, and I'll get to that in a second, absolutely could constitute an impeachable offense. Not the payments themselves, but if Trump deliberately took steps to conceal them in violation of campaign finance laws. Now, there are those who say campaign finance laws, they're violated all the time, that's treated with a fine, that's just not that serious. A technical violation of campaign finance laws cannot be the basis for removing the president. I think that's a mistaken argument. I think it's absolutely true that many campaigns violate the campaign finance rules, usually in a minor or inadvertent way, and that, of course, is not a basis for removing them from office. But if we're talking about someone deliberately violating those laws to help get himself elected, if the whole point of concealing those payments was you make those payments to quiet down these people so the public doesn't learn about certain behavior, and then you conceal the payments in direct violation of the law precisely so the public doesn't learn something they might take into account in their vote, this compromises the integrity of the election process. This is basically someone seeking an unfair advantage and an illegal advantage in the election process, and it's very much the sort of thing that clearly warrants removal from office. So I would say coordination with Russia, obstruction into the investigation of Russia, and the violation of campaign finance laws all fall on the side of could be impeachable. Trump's misuse of the pardon power, alleged misuse, and the violations, alleged violations of the Emoluments Clause, I would say, barring some development that is unforeseen, do not warrant use of the impeachment power.
Well, I'm glad you brought Stormy Daniels back into the discussion, Alan Hirsch. I have to say that Trump met his match with her. She's the only person I can think of that's just as shameless as he is.
And she and her lawyer.
And the lawyer. We could get him on violation of good taste. Anyway, Heidi had a question.
Has impeachment been used to remove any federal officers?
Yes, judges. Judges and only judges. The impeachment, historically, there have been a couple of presidents, one Secretary of Defense, and one senator. The latter two were acquitted, and primarily it's been judges who have been impeached, and any number of those have been convicted.
And what do you say to people who are calling for Justice Kavanaugh to be impeached?
That's certainly premature. But I assume you're talking about if there is investigation and it turns out that he, in fact, committed the sexual assault of which he was accused during the hearings? If that were happened, that would probably be a basis for impeachment. But I think we're getting way ahead of ourselves if we start talking about impeaching the justice based on allegations. There's one other thing that I think is really important that I call the rotten store idea. I borrow that phrase from a senator during the Nixon impeachment. So backing up just a second, one of the things I emphasize in the book and want to emphasize now is that a president cannot be impeached simply for being a bad president. Even if you think he is god-awful, the worst president ever, that's not impeachable. That's not the system of government we have. He has to have committed treason, bribery, or some other high crime and misdemeanor. However, there may be circumstances where there is a gray area, where a senator or a congressman is simply not clear on whether the particular offense rises to the level of an impeachable offense, where I think it is appropriate, maybe even mandatory, to take into account the full tenor of the administration. So I talk about, during the Nixon impeachment process, there was a senator who compared the Nixon administration to a rotten store. He said, you walk into a grocery store, you look at an apple or two and they're bruised, and you say, the fruit's no good. You move over to the vegetable section, you look at a tomato or some mushrooms and they're bruised or no good, and you say, wow, the vegetables are no good. But at a certain point, you say, this is just a rotten store. And this senator reached that conclusion about the Nixon administration. There was just corruption from top to bottom. The entire administration was rotten, so to speak. And so he decided he was going to impeach on that basis. And what I said is, that's okay if there are arguably impeachable offenses. Then it is legitimate to look at the entire administration, but only if there are impeachable offenses. So, by analogy, if someone is looking at some of the alleged grounds of impeachment for Trump and thinks he probably committed them, but they're not sure, thinks they're probably impeachable, but not sure, at that point, it would be legitimate to look at the entire administration. And that may be things like inciting the public against the media, calling the press the enemy of the people. That may be things like a travel ban that targeted a particular religion. That could be being deceitful over and over again. A lot of things. It seems to me it would be appropriate for people to look at all that in the context of a specific impeachable offense as a scale tipper, so to speak. It would not be proper just to look at those things and say, what a terrible president, we have to impeach him. That's a rests on a misunderstanding and misuse of the impeachment power.
Alan Hirsch, this has been a fascinating discussion, and we hope that our listeners will run out and get Impeaching the President, Past, Present, and Future. It's published by City Lights. The author is Alan Hirsch. Best of luck with this great and timely book.
Well, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Well, this may not be the last time. You know, if there's more news on the impeachment front with Donald Trump, you're coming back on the show, I hope.
You know where to reach me.
You take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Today we remember and celebrate the life of Mujahid Farid, who passed away last week in New York. Listeners will recall that Farid had been on Law & Disorder several times over the last few years, along with Laura Whitehorn and David George, from his organization, Release Aging Persons in Prison. In 1978, Farid was sentenced to 15 years to life in prison. At the time, he was 28 years old. He first became eligible for parole in 1993. He'd earned 4 college degrees, including 2 masters, while incarcerated. He was denied parole 9 times. As we've discussed in prior segments, New York State parole commissioners denied his requests, and those of many others, based on the nature of his crime, rather than the many accomplishments he made while in prison. In a Village Voice article, Farid noted that he asked the commissioners, "Is there anything I can do to make myself eligible for release?" He didn't get a response, but he saw disapproving changes in the body language and facial expressions of the commissioners, that his question was not welcome. And he was denied again. These denials added a total of 18 years to his incarceration. In 2011, Farid appeared before the parole board for the 10th time. He stood before 2 new commissioners who had high rates of granting parole. And that year, Farid was released. He became a 2013 Soros Justice Fellow. During his confinement in 1987, Farid was part of a trio that created and proposed the first HIV/AIDS peer education program in New York State prisons that later developed into the widely acclaimed statewide program called Prisoners AIDS Counseling and Education. Farid participated in the creation of a college certificate program sponsored by New York Theological Seminary. And he taught introduction to sociology courses for people training for alcohol and substance abuse counseling certification. Since his release, Farid initiated 2 programs designed to have an impact on dismantling mass incarceration: the RAP campaign, as we've mentioned, and the Rise and Shine Small Business Coalition, the latter providing support for the creation and startup of community businesses operating on principles of social entrepreneurship. In 2013, Farid was awarded a joint New York State legislative commendation for his community work and a Citizens Against Recidivism, Inc. award for social activism. As listeners may recall, the number of prisoners aged 50 and older in New York State, where RAP was founded, has doubled since 2000. It now exceeds 10,000, which is about 20% of the total incarcerated population. This reflects a national crisis in the prison system and the extension of a culture of revenge and punishment in all areas of our society. Let's take a listen now to a segment from one of our past interviews with Farid. Mujahid and Laura, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
And thanks for the invitation.
I wanted to start, if you would, Mujahid, by briefly telling us your personal story of how you were incarcerated and from how many years and what happened.
Okay. I'll start from maybe the time of my arrest. I was arrested in 1978 for a homicide and an attempt murder on the police officer. Actually, the attempt murder on the police officer was something that was tagged on afterwards, after the arrest. I got into a scuffle outside of a discotheque that they had at those time, at that time. And during the course of the fight, I shot one of the individuals that I was in the scuffle with. Towards the end of the fight, as I was trying to exit the scene, I heard a shot behind my back. I turned around to see exactly, you know, what was going on. And I couldn't discern because there was so much chaos, large crowd out there, everybody ripping and running. So I proceeded. And a few blocks away, I got cordoned off and arrested. Later on, as they processed the charges against me, I learned that the shot that occurred behind me was a plainclothes police officer. And then he claimed that I actually turned around and tried to fire my weapon at him. He says that he heard a click during this chaos. And that then after the click, I proceeded to run again. He pretty much added that part in. I went to trial. I actually wasn't convicted of the person I killed. I had a justification defense. But I was convicted of the attempt on the police officer. An attempt at that time of a police officer carried the same penalty as completing the act. So the least I could have gotten for that conviction was 15 years to life, which was what the judge gave me. I proceeded. I entered the system. I didn't expect to serve the time, I mean, because I always, my line was always, how is it possible to prove something beyond a reasonable doubt that never happened? I mean, I thought that was an impossibility, and I thought I would get it a reversal. And so I began entrenching myself in the law almost from day one and working at getting that reversal. That didn't happen. But during the course of my serving the time, one of the things I also did was to tell myself that I shouldn't waste a day that I'm in the system, that I should try to take advantage of all of my time and try to turn it around and get some benefit out of it.
Well, let's talk about what you did, because it turned out 15 years to life turned out to be 33 years.
That's right.
And how many denials of parole?
Nine denials. I was released at the 10th board.
Whoa. Well, but in the interim, you're in prison. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what you did. How many college degrees did you get?
I got actually 4 degrees, from associate's, bachelor's, to 2 graduate degrees.
And were you involved in any programs helping prisoners?
Quite a few programs. I actually was involved in creating certain programs, stellar programs that still exist today.
Really? What programs?
Well, one of them is called PACE, Prisoners, AIDS, Counseling, and Education. And it grew out of something that we actually started in Auburn called PEPA. The idea came out of Auburn, a small crew of us brainstormed the PEPA program and pretty much got disbanded by transferring all of us throughout the state. But when I wound up at another facility, we continued to work, and PACE got established and pretty much is still doing the work.
Let's talk about the parole system, because we want to talk about how it really doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And the situation of huge population of elderly people in prison as a consequence. You came up for parole how many times?
10 times. I made the 10th parole board, and that's like every 2 years.
And tell us what it's like to prepare, and who do you talk to, and what do you say? I mean, what does one do to try to get out on parole?
And do you have witnesses there who speak on your behalf?
No, there's no one that appears on your behalf at the parole board. You can't have legal representation there. You're on your own, and they pretty much very fast proceedings. on average, I would say, especially from someone that was situated as I was, they last about 4 to 5 minutes.
After 2 years. And do you actually speak with these people in person, or is it?
When I originally started going, they were live personal interviews. And I think my first 3 or 4 parole boards were those type of hearings. And then they switched to using teleconference.
And what made the difference on that final appearance?
Now, that's a long story, but a lot of things went on between that 9th and 10th parole boards. But I'm going to point to the major difference as a parole commissioner that was on that board. It was a former nun, and she was known. She bucked the system for a while, for the brief period that she was on the parole board. And I happened to get her at that last board.
Ujjay, let me ask you this. It seems to me what a parole board should do is look at the prisoner as he or she is now, not what she was then, but allowing for people to change and improve themselves.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the whole concept of parole, I think.
Yeah, I do too. But it seems to me that instead of that, there's a stigma. They say once a criminal, always a criminal, and they keep you in there because of the crime you committed many years ago. Was that your experience?
Yeah, what happened was, my experience was that over time, as this punishment paradigm began to take root in the society, that the parole boards were co-opted into that process.
You know, we say the parole system is broken. It's broken from the standpoint of justice. It's broken from the standpoint of public safety, because the decisions of the parole board are based on revenge and, as you said, going back 40 years in some cases to what someone did when they were 19 or 20 years old, not looking at them now. And so in terms of public safety, the people that are being denied pose the lowest risk to public safety. However, if you look at it from the standpoint of carrying out a system of revenge against, primarily against black people and other people of color, then the parole board works because it keeps people in over and over again, denies them their humanity. So we're talking about changing the parole process so that it meets its original purpose that one would imagine it would have, which is to judge, are you now the same person you were? Will you lead a law-abiding, constructive life? And Fareed and I worked with a lot of people who are examples of how you can lead not only a law-abiding life, but a creative one and contribute to a community. And the people we're concerned about through RAP are exactly those people.
And as the prison population gets older, the longer people are incarcerated, obviously this is becoming a larger problem of so many elder people behind bars.
New York State right now, more than 17% of the incarcerated population are people over the age of 50. And we use the age of 50 because people age faster in prison because of the conditions, the stress.
When you talk about objective standards, what are we talking about? What would you like to have these parole boards confine themselves to?
Our slogan, I think, spells that out completely. We're saying, our slogan is, if the risk is low, let them go. And, of course, that can apply across the board on the age scale. But we know for sure that we use it because the population that we are focusing on, almost to a person, score low risk for committing a crime upon release or recidivating.
What kinds of challenges, if any, have been brought in the courts in New York State against this system?
There's quite a few challenges going on, and we're trying to develop one of them into some of our strategizing, our organizing. And what that entails is that recently some courts have held the parole board in contempt for refusing to engage in a forward-looking process when they conduct these hearings. There's a lot of stuff that's behind that also. I think I need to say that historically there's been this position that the courts don't have the power to order a person's release, that all they can do is to order a new hearing, a de novo hearing for an individual who the parole board pretty much violates their rights during the course of a hearing. And that has created a problem because the parole board is known to thumb his nose at the courts. The court may order a new hearing and the parole board has pretty much done the same thing all over again. And so that's been called the merry-go-round. Some courts have become so frustrated with that merry-go-round that they have held the board in contempt. They have ordered the parole board to pay counsel fees or daily costs to the individual until a new de novo hearing is held that gives the person the full scope of rights at the hearing.
Who appoints the parole board members?
The governor.
Yes.
Do you have any support of either former law enforcement officials who have spoken out on this or even current ones?
Yes, we do. You'll see some in the material that I gave you, in that white paper, former DOCS commissioner, former parole board chairperson has actually submitted papers for that report.
It seems to me that this is an instance in which community organizing, which you're obviously doing, and public outcry, humanizing stories of the individuals whose lives have been spent behind bars, is a good approach to take since legal venues are slim.
Absolutely.
But we also do need the support, again, of the legal community. And in this white paper, which is called Aging in Prison, Reducing Elder Incarceration and Promoting Public Safety. And the reason it's called that is that the release of elders would promote, not just not challenge, but would promote public safety because it would free up the funds to go back into communities as opposed to going into, you know, chains and bars and overtime for prison guards. And it would adjust the system. It would begin to correct this horrible problem we have in this country of mass incarceration. But in this white paper, we have a paper from the former chairman of the New York Parole Board, Edward Hammack. We have a paper from Brian Fisher, the former head of the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision for New York. And there are other former parole commissioners who have signed amicus briefs saying that the law enforcement community is exerting too much power over the process. And we are trying to focus this through community support and through organizing the legal community and other professional communities to make a demand on the system and on the governor, in addition to passing legislation, which we support, called the Safe Parole Act. But we don't even need to do that to begin to release some of these elders.
We're talking to two former prisoners, Laura Whitehorn and Mujahid Farid. They are the principal people organizing Release Aging People in Prison, RAP. You just made reference to a paper that you put out. Tell us the name of the paper and how our listeners can get a hold of it.
Well, it's called, the name is a little long. It's Aging in Prison, colon, Reducing Elder Incarceration and Promoting Public Safety. It was issued this month by the Columbia University Center for Justice, the Center for Justice at Columbia University. And if people go on their website, they can find it. If they go on our website, rapcampaign.com, that's R-A-P as in people, P as in prison, campaign.com, they can find a link to the report. It's quite lengthy.
I'm curious what the rationale from the other side of this issue is. What possible justification can law enforcement and others be making?
I think you would see this, the answer to that, reflected not only in the criminal justice arena, but throughout social systems in this country. This propensity to punish, to extract blood out of those most on the lowest of the so-called social scale. We see it in the welfare system. We see it in the school systems. We see it all over, this propensity to punish. And we argue that this is actually traceable to the institution of slavery.
You use the term decarcerate. It's a wonderful term. That resonates. Talk about decarcerate.
I use the term dismantle. And sometimes I have to work with decarcerate because, you know, that's what others use.
You're going for the big picture here.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the big picture because, my opinion, not only does the parole system not work, the whole prison system doesn't work. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be some provisions for really violent people that could hurt you. I mean, that's a different question. But in the main, I don't think the prison system works. And when you say it goes back to slavery, talk about that.
Well, I'm saying that it's not just the prison system. I'm saying it's the whole social system. Marie Gosselaar, she's an authority on this stuff. And she's out of the University of Pennsylvania. She is now elevating the conversation, the narrative, to talk about the carceral system, not just mass incarceration, but the carceral system, which shows that this propensity to punish and this propensity to penalize is reflected not only in prisons, but throughout the society. She is arguing that now, like corporations like the American Correctional Association, which is big into making money off of prisons, that they realizing that something is going to be done. They realize something is going to be done because we have this bipartisan, so-called bipartisan concern now about decarcerating, I'll use that term. And that, so them realizing that something's going to be done is going to the drawing board, strategizing other ways to continue to make money off of penal processes, such as ankle bracelets, probation systems, and all of that kind of stuff. That, it's a lot bigger than just prison.
And also, when we talk about it going back to slavery, what happened after slavery, when it was outlawed, is Jim Crow. And the prison system was a major enforcer of Jim Crow laws. And then during the 70s, when I became political and started, you know, agitating against the war in Vietnam, against racism, I saw leaders of the black struggle being incarcerated, some of whom are still in prison today, some of whom are in New York and fall within this population we're talking about. And then we saw the drug wars, quote unquote, where thousands and thousands of young black people were incarcerated for basically nothing. So we see consistently a system of repression. But, I mean, we've started even to talk, you know, people talk about ending mass incarceration. We do want to end mass incarceration. It was a travesty. It locked up all these young people and older people for nothing. However, if we ended mass incarceration, which is why I think we don't use the word decarcerate so much, the numbers would go down, but the system would still be in place.
We started our interview, and we just have a few minutes left, mentioning that Mujahid had not only gotten several degrees, but was a jailhouse lawyer while you were inside. Did you assist others in filing claims?
Yes.
And what was there a great need for that, I imagine?
Absolutely. As you probably know, as an attorney, Gideon doesn't extend to civil litigation, and once you're convicted, even habeas corpus is considered civil. And so much of the court proceedings that you'll find coming from people behind the walls, it will be classified as civil actions, and the state is not going to provide representation. So the representation that the people get, the state is basically required to provide law libraries and assistance through law libraries.
And you were transferred how many times in New York State? How many facilities were you in?
Oh, I didn't really count them, but most of the maximum security facilities I spent some time at, and that would probably be about, 15 or 20. And a couple of the medium security facilities I spent some time in.
How did this affect your family? some of those prisons are like 400 miles
away.
So telephone calls are really expensive.
Right.
Or they were.
There was long periods of time when my fundamental way of communicating was telephone, not visits. So that was when I spent quite a bit of time up near the Canadian border, either directly north or near Buffalo. Visits were far and few in between.
If our listeners are interested in getting involved or learning more, is there a website or resource that they can turn to?
Yes, we have a website where they can get all of the information to engage themselves in this work with us. And the website is RAP Campaign, that's two P's, RAPP campaign.com. And you, from there, you can get the address of where we do the work, when our meetings are held, and a lot of other information.
And one thing you can find, if you go on that website and you go to About, in the upper right-hand corner, there's a place with a link to sign a petition that we have that's directed to the governor, to legislators, to anyone who has any clout, saying release aging people in prison. It's very basic, and we would like to get 30,000 signatures so that we can bring them to the governor and say, time to do something here.
Well, Laura, we got a lot of listeners, and I can tell you that they're going to help. Mujahid, thank you very much. We certainly appreciate your coming down to the studio and being on Law and Disorder.
And again, thank you for inviting us.
That was a past interview with Mujahid Fareed. May he rest in peace. We encourage our listeners to go to the RAP website. It's rapcampaign.com, rappcampaign.com. If you're interested in learning more about the work that Fareed was instrumental in starting and that still continues.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.
And say,